Hello, it's Rob Parsons here with another episode of the Northern Agenda podcast, bringing you political news and analysis about the north of England from outside the Westminster bubble. Let's start today's episode with a question. Why is it that bright, young people from the north are so much less likely to apply for our two most prestigious universities, Cambridge and Oxford, than their counterparts in the southeast and London? It's a question that gets right to the heart of our north-south divide, and we try and answer it with the help of a Cambridge academic who got a place there as a working-class daughter of a cleaner from Greater Manchester. She's now trying to ensure more people like her follow the same path. This week, I've been working on a big project ahead of the general election. You'll find out more next week, but it's taken me to one of our best-loved seaside resorts. I've come back with a stick of rock and a host of interesting stories from communities that will likely be getting lots of political attention in the coming weeks. But there have been a few stories in the north that have caught my eye in the last few days. In Manchester, a Labour councillor pulled a chicken head mask out of his bag and started wearing it in front of his surprised colleagues in a publicity stunt to encourage Rishi Sunak to name a date for the general election. Meanwhile, in Bradford, the One Direction singer Zayn Malik is the new face of the City of Culture Year 2025 for the city where he grew up. Will the year of cultural events put the West Yorkshire city on the map? And in Sheffield, the Labour-run City Council has decided to ban adverts for unhealthy food, gambling, vaping products and airlines on the advertising hoardings it owns in the city, prompting anger from some right-wingers who say it's intervening too much in what people do with their money. I'd love to know what you think about some of these issues. Drop me a line at rob.parsons@reachplc.com. And now let's hear from this week's interview. Back in 1989, a young Andy Burnham recalls going back from his Merseyside home to Cambridge University's Fitzwilliam College, where he was studying, to find his fellow students, in Mr. Burnham's words, pretty much oblivious to the Hillsborough disaster that devastated so many lives just a few days earlier. Now Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham describes the disconnect between what he describes as a traumatised Northwest and his elite university as one of the most difficult experiences I can remember at that age. More than three decades on, all sides have been making an effort to ensure more Northern students get in to Oxford and Cambridge universities, still seen by many as the country's most prestigious seats of learning. So it's striking to note that in the 2019-2020 year, 67% of school leavers who went to Oxbridge from state-funded schools and colleges came from either the South East or London, and only 20% came from the North. At Cambridge University itself, the issue is on the minds of senior leaders. Last month, its Vice-Chancellor, Deborah Prentice, came up to Liverpool to see what she could do to encourage more of the city's brightest young people to apply. And this week, at Haydock Park in Merseyside, Cambridge colleges with links to the North West held a day-long conference attended by hundreds of local students with the aim of encouraging more applications. One of the organisers is my guest today, the Director of Admissions at Cambridge's Pembroke College, Dr. Caroline Burt. Dr. Burt came to Cambridge to study for her degree as a first-generation working-class student from Manchester and is now passionate about widening participation, equity of opportunity in education, and helping all students to fulfil their potential. It was announced just a few days ago that Cambridge is dropping its admission targets for undergraduates coming from state schools. So how does it hope to get a student body that better reflects the population of this country? Let's find out. So Caroline, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Nice to have you on. So why don't we start by getting you to tell us your story. Where did you grow up and how big a deal was it for you to get into Cambridge as a working class student from Manchester and the daughter of a cleaner, I believe?
Yeah, that's right. A massive deal, to be honest with you. So I grew up in Timperley, home of Frank Sidebottom, for anybody who knows Timperley, and just went to initially primary school in Timperley, progressed on in the end to Loretto Grammar in Altrincham, passed my 11 plus to get there. My parents were both Mancunians, and neither of them had been to university. And in fact, if I take my mum's family as an example, the background was not just one of not very much money, but really serious socioeconomic challenges is what we would say now. So she grew up in the what became known as the slums of central Manchester, and she was part of the slum clearance post-war. She was born in 39. And I remember as a small child her telling me about things like, you know, when you turn the lights on at night, you'd see all the bugs climbing on the walls and stuff like that. This was just nothing I saw as a kid. So that gives you a sense of where she'd come from. There just weren't opportunities to even begin to think about university for people like them. So my mum trained as a machinist in a clothes factory, and my dad ended up working for British Airways in cargo in Manchester Airport. And they were just really enthusiastic about me and my brother having the opportunities that they hadn't had, you know, and they wanted to give us anything that would make that possible, not in a pushy way at all. They just wanted their kids to have lives that they hadn't had. So like they used to, the man from the Prue, if people are old enough to remember, the man from the Prue used to come to the front door, I think it was once a week, to collect the savings that they were putting away for us to have, you know, whatever sort of education we wanted, but hopefully education at university. So yeah, went to grammar school, did well, got some encouragement from teachers, had a fantastic history teacher, and started to think about applying to Cambridge, just really because they'd given me that encouragement. It's not something I would have thought of if I hadn't had teachers saying it to me. You know, that didn't really happen to people like me. You know, I used to go on the back of my mum's bike to cleaning jobs with her. Those people's kids, all of whom were very nice, by the way, it was those people's kids who went to places like this, not people like me. So to be encouraged by teachers was the way it happened. It's the only way it could have happened for me. So that's how I started to think about Cambridge and actually Oxford, obviously.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And so once you got into Cambridge, I mean, the description that Andy Burnham gives of sort of a bit of a disconnect between someone from his background in the Northwest and the types of people who you imagine going to Cambridge being quite stark. I mean, is that how it felt to you as well when you arrived there?
Only to some extent, if I'm honest with you. So I went to Churchill College, which is a 20th century Cambridge college. And at that time was known for having very large numbers of state school students, which is why I'd applied there, because I was worried I wouldn't fit in other places, which incidentally I wouldn't have been right about, I would have done. But if you were at Churchill, you were surrounded by a lot of kids from very similar sorts of backgrounds. There were other Northerners, without a doubt, but they were in the minority. You know, there weren't huge numbers of other people there from my neck of the woods. There were people from similar backgrounds. But yeah, there were also people from much more privileged backgrounds than me. I remember feeling a bit, I wouldn't say intimidated. I remember not telling people my mum was a cleaner because I didn't know how people would react to me. I was always very, very proud of her, but always very defensive of her. So obviously I didn't want to put myself in a situation where somebody would be unpleasant. But actually, I think that was probably a bit more about me than it was about the environment, because my experience was of everyone actually being extremely nice. I think coming from that background, and I hear this from other kids even now, I think the barriers a lot of the time are the ones that are in, I don't mean to downplay them at all, but they're in your head as well, because you're out of your comfort zone and you're trying to find a place for yourself. And the natural instinct is to think, well, I don't fit in here. There aren't enough people like me. Something's wrong. And actually, there are quite a lot of people like you. You're probably just not realizing that there are, and you can fit in and you can be absolutely fine. But I think it's nerve-wracking. And it was nerve-wracking for me, just as it is for kids now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting you talk about some of the barriers being perhaps the way that the kids themselves perceive it. I mean, from your perspective now, as someone who is really interested in the broader issue of how to get better representation, we were talking earlier about the stats as they are at the moment, the big disparity between the number of kids from northern state schools and those from state schools in the southeast of London who go to Cambridge. How much of that is down to these issues of perception that you talk about, you know, perhaps people from the north thinking that Oxbridge is more expensive and less friendly and like not the place for them. How much of it is that, and how much of it is sort of disparities in the number of kids who get the right A levels to actually get into Cambridge in the first place? Because obviously the academic standards are very high, aren't they, to get into Cambridge? I mean, is it a bit of both?
It's a bit of both. It's what you'd expect. But I mean, I think there are quite a few kids who get the grades who don't apply to us. So you've got to say, well, what are the issues there? And it's very easy to say, well, you know, it was to a significant extent about where I was in my own head and with my own identity. And I completely get that. But equally, looking at it from the other side now, our job then is to reach out and help people across what feels like a divide to them that maybe more apparent a divide than it is real. But if it feels real, it doesn't really matter that it's apparent. That makes sense. So we actually have to come out and talk to people and not just say, well, we're very welcoming, come to us, because that's not straightforwardly something that people will have the confidence to do, I think.
No. And is that what the events like the one you had at Haydock Park this week are about, sort of presenting a perhaps a more human face to Cambridge University, to kids from the north who perhaps perceive it to be an institution that is quite divorced from their sort of their lives?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, look, if I'm somewhere and someone's at a distance and they say, oh, well, please, you know, you're very welcome, come to me, I might go. If somebody comes to me and actually talks to me, that makes a hell of a difference to how I'm interacting with that person and that institution, you know. So to me, I think if we want more people from the north, we have to come here and talk to people and actually tell them about what the realities are and tell them, you know, about the fact that people like me have gone before them. And it's actually, you know, it's a great place. It may not be the right place for you, but not because you're not going to fit in socially, because maybe we don't offer the course you want, or maybe this other university has something that you know, you particularly would like. But don't rule yourself out because you think you're not going to fit. That message has to come to the students themselves. You've got, a lot of the time, you've got quite significant confidence barriers with people. And it's like anything in life, the unknown unnerves us, no matter who we are. So you've got to make that more known. And if you don't actually physically come, that's much harder to do.
Do you think things have improved in this regard in the last few years or in recent decades? Is there evidence to say that sort of inroads are being made into this problem?
Yeah, well, I mean, the stats speak for themselves. So yes, that makes it absolutely clear. When I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, there was no end of goodwill. You know, I think the perception that I had would have been, you know, I won't fit in here. There'll be no one like me. They don't want people like me. They don't understand people like me. And actually, those were the bits that were wrong. They did want people like me. They did understand because I was interested in history, and they understood history because that's what they were teaching, and we all loved history. So, of course, we all got each other. I think what's changed is, one, understanding what we need to do to get those messages out and how actually it's so important that you do that proactively. I think, two, technology opens so many more doors. So, okay, this was a physical visit, but we've got so many other things that enable us to reach out, and that's created improvements. And I think just, you know, more people coming from backgrounds like mine and saying, look, you've got to understand that however much we want to welcome those students and however much it really matters to us that we just get the best students, because of the lack of confidence that so many people have, you've got to go and talk to them. Now, if you haven't got as many people coming from those sorts of backgrounds, there aren't those people to say, listen, your goodwill is brilliant. Let's make that goodwill into something that's going to deliver something.
Yeah, no, I get that. So listeners to this podcast might have seen the news story I mentioned earlier, which is that Cambridge is scrapping its admission targets for undergraduates coming from state schools and is going to take a new approach, which I think the university is in the process of drawing up. Can you just explain the thinking there? Because I think some people might see that headline and think, well, isn't that a backward step?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would really reassure on that front. One of the things we've now got is a lot more information about people that gives us a context. You know, for example, the levels of socioeconomic deprivation in the area that someone lives, the performance of their specific school, not just whether it's an independent school or a state school, but actually how well people at that school do, how many of those students from that school will go to places like Oxford and Cambridge. So we're looking at all of that sort of thing. As well, we're getting data now about things like free school meals and how many students are in receipt of free school meals. And all of this starts to put together a much more nuanced, a much more granular picture than we've had before. So state independent is a helpful proxy measure of these sorts of things. But actually, if you've got lots of this sort of data and information, then that is actually extraordinarily helpful to you at making much more nuanced judgments. That said, I think there's no sense in which we are going to just start ignoring people's general school background. We're not going to do that. We are going to still be knowing which type of school they've been to. We're going to do it exactly as we've done it previously, which is we're not going to say, oh, well, you've been to this school, you can't come. We're going to say, let's look at that person in the context of what we know about them and their school, etc. So that's all still going to be there. I think that there is just generally out there in regulatory terms as well, a sense that we can do this in a more sophisticated way now. We've just got a lot more information. So I think that in a way, it's much more positive than it was before. It's not a retrograde step. It's an indication that actually there are so many different ways in which we can measure this stuff and understand people so that we can make the best decisions that are fair to everyone.
Now, one argument I often hear when I cover these kinds of issues from sort of academic people in the north of England is, well, why are we talking about Oxbridge all the time? So what if northern kids can't get into Oxbridge or don't want to go? There are loads of good universities in the north of England, you know, Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, York, Durham, Newcastle. The list goes on. Can't bright kids from the north just go to these universities? Why does it matter that not enough northern kids are going to Cambridge?
So the first thing I would say is, As a very proud Mancunian, I'm extremely proud of our universities, not just in Manchester, but the north of England overall. So I don't dispute, you know, what you're saying there. We're very, very lucky in the north of England in the choice that we have. My point about all of this is that it's about people having freedom of choice. So, yes, they should have a choice about whether they think, I want to stay in Manchester, or the course in Liverpool is brilliant for me, I want to go there, or whatever it may be. But that choice should extend to anywhere. And that geographically, that doesn't matter. So, you know, I would say the same to somebody from Surrey. You know, well, look, there's a lot of damn good universities in the north of England. I hope you're thinking about them. For me, it's about saying then, what courses are they offering? How good are they for their courses? What's the teaching like? Doing all of those sorts of things. I think the second thing is, and it's connected with that choice point, Oxford and Cambridge are two universities that have historically been seen as elite, socially as well as academically. And it's very, very important that people understand that they can be on their radar, that this is not, they are not institutions that only the social elite go to. And that's a message we have to get across because it hasn't always been there. And I think as well, you know, Cambridge is a fantastic university in worldwide terms. We're very lucky in the UK, actually. We've got a big cluster of universities that rank right up there in the world as a whole. But, you know, Cambridge is a world-leading university. So I think it would be a bit weird if somewhere like Cambridge were not trying to recruit as broadly as possible geographically. And I just think, let kids make their choice, but make sure that they understand that everywhere's open to them.
That's a very fair point. Now, a final question, Caroline. You're a historian, as you mentioned. I was interested to see you've got a book out called Arise England, Six Kings and the Making of the English State. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Can do better than that. I can actually wave you a physical copy.
It's a very chunky looking book.
So 10 years in the making. It's published for a wider audience than academic. It's supposed to be a book for students and the general public who really like reading about history, don't necessarily want to do a degree in history, not necessarily have done a degree, don't want to necessarily do a doctorate in history, but they want to understand about an interesting period in British history. And so that's the aim of the book. It's basically a kind of mixture of talking about how the English state developed in the period, things like where does Parliament come from, why do we have a system of national taxation, how did our legal system develop, how it did, but then looking at it through the lens of six reigns. And within the six reigns, you've got two kings who were deposed in the most brutal circumstances, so that's quite entertaining. You've got King John, who literally would have your eyes gouged out if he didn't like you, so that's particularly interesting to read about, in the sense that, you know, life in King John's reign, if you're interacting with the kings, of roller coaster. So just stories of these individuals and how their agency made a difference to people's lives, how it helped form the English state, but also the extent to which then as now, if you're in any sort of political role, you're part of a current that drags you along with it, whether that's ideas or circumstances, and you've got your own agency, and you've got your citizens or your subjects saying, well, we want this from you. And it talks about leadership for the common good, leadership for everybody's well-being, and the importance of good leadership, and how you can deliver that, and what happens to everybody when that goes horribly wrong. So it's sort of trying to do lots of different things, but hopefully in an entertaining way anyway.
Horrible things happen when leadership goes wrong. I think that's something listeners to the Northern Agenda could probably agree with about politics in 2024. So very, very, sounds very relevant. Dr. Caroline Burt, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.